Welcome to our Nunera webinar. This month, Finding Home and Beating the Housing Crisis. I am thrilled today to bring together some amazing women from across Hamilton that have been working diligently on this file for years and years and years. I won't say how long because I don't want to give myself away during the chat and how old I've been and how long I've been doing this myself. But we have today Michelle Baird, Director of Housing Services for the City of Hamilton, Katrina Gervais, Housing Advocate and member of the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction. And we also have Renee Wessler, Executive Director of St. Matt's, and Ashley Wilson, Staff Lawyer and Tenant Support Program with the Hamilton Community Legal Clinic. And of course, there's myself, Laura Katari, and I come to you from the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction. This is a huge, huge file. And to kick us off, I'm going to use a housing announcement from May 12th, just last week, from the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing. And they're putting together an act called Protect Ontario by Building Faster and Smarter Act of 2025. And as per usual, it talks about, you know, speeding up new homes and infrastructure, eliminating red tape. I think we've heard this before, adding $400 million in immediate funding, and just everything to do with municipal works. It's quite a complex bill that's coming forward. And I think I'm going to kick us off with the municipality itself. So, Michelle, if you're okay with that, do you want to respond to this act and how it fits in with where you want to go here in Hamilton with our programming?
Thanks, Laura. I appreciate that question. So for us, of course, anything that's being done with respect to making it easier to build homes, building more homes more generally, certainly is good news and news that we welcome. In Hamilton, we continue to see the pressing issues with respect to homelessness, and not just people that are currently truly unhoused, but those who are precariously housed where they are or are looking to move from where they currently live to perhaps a situation that's better suited to their family. And there are limitations and challenges around all of those different pieces. So for us, seeing new houses built, certainly good news, making it easier to build new homes, because we hear that from the community that it's been a challenge, that there is red tape. So that is all good news. I think the piece that's still missing for us, though, is funding around the operational dollars to make these real. So building a house, building a home, that physical capital certainly is one piece. But as we all know, that we need some supports around rents. We need supports for supportive housing to truly see people housed and to ensure that we're keeping people housed. It takes a bit more than that.
That was the perfect kickoff and handoff. So thank you for that, Michelle. And talking about supports, I'd like to jump to Renee for a moment. Renee, do you want to talk about supportive housing and possibly gaps? What's your take on this right now?
First of all, thanks for having me on this afternoon, Laura, and to the roundtable as well. Delighted to be here. I echo everything that Michelle just said, and I laud the City of Hamilton's willingness to be an advocate on this particular file and in this particular way. When it comes to supports, Michelle is right. Even if we can build more, faster, I don't want to say bigger, because I don't always agree that bigger is not necessarily better. However, you know, the connection between health and housing has certainly been made in all the research that we do. And income supports are certainly needed. And what we all worry about is who these homes are being built for and how will they be financed. So, for example, we are just about finishing a modular build, which we had a lot of red tape at the outset getting that thing built. But certainly once we hit that sweet spot, everything went really quickly and it's going to be great. And we're ensuring that the supports are in place even before we start to house people because we recognize the importance of it. We're cobbling it together. We're pulling from this pot and that pot to make sure that that is in place. And what we want to ensure is that that's not just a short-term solution, but alongside a 20-year housing, social housing agreement that we will be entering into with the city of Hamilton. And will these kind of agreements and will this kind of work happen again, or can it happen again, and can it go forward? It costs, you know, a lot of money to keep people housed for long periods of time. We're certainly building a permanent solution. And what we hope that is that over time, as people settle into the housing experience, you know, maybe less supports are needed. But again, this is just our particular build. And, you know, we have a lot of plans on the table. Hopefully the red tape will go away. But we don't want to put anyone at risk once we've housed them. And I think that that's certainly what can happen and we have seen happen. And so, yeah, I'm sure that Katrina would want to advocate for this particular piece as well.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Perfect segue. And that's where I was going to go. So, Katrina, I think I'm just going to let you fly with this. I think talking about sports is really important. So please.
Okay, well, I'll just jump right in and say that I found myself actually I'd run out of couches to surf on. So obviously I'd been in some precarious housing situations until I found myself without a couch in 2012. I went into a shelter for about 4 weeks, and then I went into a transitional home for about 21 months while, you know, we tried to find, well, I addressed some issues and then tried to find some affordable housing. And then my health deteriorated, and eventually I applied and got a place at Indwell, which now meets some physical challenges I have. And it's been a bit of a roller coaster. So initially I was receiving a lot of supports in the transitional home. And then once I got my apartment, I just assumed, like many people, that it would be smooth sailing. I had an apartment and everything would be great from here on in. And that's not exactly what happened. Apparently, there was still some stuff I needed to address. And then from there, I got an autoimmune illness, et cetera, et cetera. My needs changed. So then I had to apply. Because this was a number of years ago now, the supports I needed weren't there after I got into the home and into the first apartment. And I didn't know that I was going to need more. And again, it was still kind of new at that point. And then since then, I've been able to reach out, and there's so many great organizations in the community. Sometimes you just have to know who to reach out to or who to go to. And I was lucky enough to have some names and to some contacts, and I got what I needed. Now I'm in Indwell. There's a lot of support here, but what I am finding even in Indwell, I'm in a building for, I'd say it's an independent building. So you need to be able to look after yourself to live here, although it does, it is an accessible building. So I have found that although it meets my needs, maybe some of my neighbors, it doesn't meet their needs. And so maybe in the near future, they would have to move to a facility or another home where it does meet their needs and they still need more supports, et cetera, et cetera. So I, you know, I'm fortunate enough now to be in a place where I don't need it, but I do see my neighbors who do need the extra supports. So it is there. And I guess a lot of it depends too on some history and maybe how long they were unhoused and different things like that. But anyways, those are my experiences. I will say in Hamilton, there is a lot of wonderful resources. And just being here on this panel shows you, you know, what happens when you meet the right people.
You've brought up so many issues in this. Everything from the supports you need, and that it's cyclical. You can be in stable housing, and then due to circumstances, this becomes more precarious. And I apologize now. I live downtown, and I do have a window open. So if you hear trucks and ambulances, I will try and close my mic. I'm going to tag Ashley here, because housing precarity, people that are already housed with changing circumstances. Can you talk to us about what's happening and the tenant support program as well?
Yeah, thanks, Laura. I think the things that people have said have brought up some really important items, right? I think Renee mentioned, you know, it's great to build new housing, but who's that housing for? And so the people that I'm working with are primarily people who are currently housed, but who are often imminently facing homelessness, where, you know, depending on the outcome of the legal process that they're in, maybe seriously looking at the next step is there's nowhere to go. I mean, when we're thinking about what the Ontario government is doing, they're building housing, but we know that the Ontario government is the one that's responsible for all of the tenant protections that we have, is responsible for things like our healthcare system, which can be involved in those wraparound supports that people need, universal basic income. There's so many things that intertwine together that really impact the health and well-being and the housing status for the people that we're working with. So the tenant support program specifically works with tenants who are facing what we colloquially call no-fault evictions. So those are evictions where the tenant hasn't missed rent, there's no alleged behavioral issues. The tenant is being evicted because the landlord says they're going to move in or because they're going to do major repairs and renovations. And what we've seen is a huge abuse of those processes, specifically because they are no-fault evictions. And the way our housing system is set up is that it's a financialized system. It's a commodity. It's an investment for these landlords. And when they think, hey, I can get this tenant out of my house and I can double that rent, they want to do it. And so they're taking advantage of those systems. And those are the tenants that the tenant support program is trying to work with to keep those people housed. But what we often find is it's really difficult to know that the landlord is gaming the system in advance. You only find out after the fact, after somebody has been evicted, they've lost their housing, they become homeless, that, oh, that landlord didn't really move in or they didn't do those renovations. And so those are all areas where there's a lot of opportunity if there were, you know, political will to create extensive protections for tenants to keep them in their housing. But at the end of the day, we're talking about a financialized system, a commodified housing system, and there's always going to be incentives for landlords and private market people to, you know, increase their profits. And that's why I think we also need to really keep our eye on social housing and rent geared to income. And that's something where the, you know, the province and municipality are obviously, you know, kind of co-contributors on that front.
Fantastic. You all know your portfolios perfectly. So I'm going to loosen this up a bit, but I'm going to throw out there, through my work in the community, the people I've met, the researchers, academics, talking about two different streams of people, and it could actually be more than that, but for now, let's say two streams. because the huge elephant in this conversation is affordability for everyone. And what is affordable for someone employed, even at minimum wage, is not the same as affordable for people on social assistance. And social assistance, I don't think the rates are sustainable for people to maintain apartment buildings filled with people on social assistance. It's not enough. It needs additional funding to make that happen. So we have two conversations. We talk about needing to raise the rates, housing stability benefits perhaps in that area, the way I first understood housing benefits, which is not what happens today, and making it affordable for people, median income and below. You know, if you have $40,000 a year and you're a single, that's doable. But what if you're only making $27,000 a year or $30,000? And what starts to be okay as you go down the income ladder, people become in a more precarious position. So looking at from your perspectives, what are the critical areas to your work that intersect with income right now? I think Ashley really started going down that road. But yes, you know, rent eviction is also hugely impossible. Supportive housing, do we have enough income from the tenant? And what kind of funding do you need on top of that to make that building work? Everyone, just jump in. I don't want to hold you back.
Mind if I jump in?
Go ahead, Renee.
So I want to just tell you a quick story about how St. Matthew's House has been or is looking to help provide a solution. I don't like using the words deal with because, it makes people sound like a problem and people are not a problem. The system's a problem, right? So what we're doing is we took down a food bank that was falling into Barton Street. And at the time, it was very controversial to think about closing a food bank. But even then, for me and for us, the evidence proved that solutions like that are very short term and they don't provide long term solutions. So we changed our thinking up and we started moving towards food delivery for seniors. Right. And lucky for us, we had started that because the pandemic hit and we continued that service and we learned a lot about people in older adults and what was happening from them at the time. And that really ended up informing the work that we're doing with the 412. So the 412 now is a modular build. It's 15 units, deeply affordable. And we are directing this to Black and Indigenous seniors. So we're working with multiple community partners, ensuring that the supports are culturally and socially and spiritually and people-centered appropriate, right? So these are just a quick layer of considerations. And then ensuring that there's the affordability, but also ensuring the food security piece to then come together with the income support, which is coming through and with our partners at the city. So you can imagine all of these big streams needing to come together to support 15 people. Now, the one thing that I think we managed to hit with this build is I call it a bit of a sweet spot. Some people call it the missing middle. And this is where I like to point to the notion of scale. When you're talking about doing a build that can be affordable, and another reason, I think smaller buildings are healthier than big, tall buildings, but that's a whole other discussion. But you can imagine then as a social housing provider now, as we're known, also a social service agency, You can hear that, you know, we're taking on a lot of liability and responsibility. And so in the sector, we see, you know, all of our partners, you know, Indwell, Good Shepherd, Mission Services, Kiwanis, all struggling to try and make that sweet spot happen. What you don't see or hear necessarily is the private developers or the market. And they are not incentivized to step into this because there's no money to be made. And as Ashley said, evictions are, you know, happening all the time. So I guess I point this back to others maybe around the table is we managed to kind of hit a sweet spot. But how do we replicate that for others, knowing that we're a small social service agency that has taken on a big responsibility? And we stepped into the fray in a way to say, if we can do it, why can't others do it, right? It's not about profitability. It's literally about saving lives at the end of the day. As we know, food security, housing, and income security does, right? So I'll throw it back to others. How can we stir up more of this type of work in this community? And maybe I'll throw it over to Michelle.
Thanks, Renee. And I'm not so sure that I have solutions either, but I think that there are lots of solutions out there. When we talk about rent geared income housing, that's probably, I would say, the largest proportion of our truly affordable housing that maintains in an affordable arena within the city. So rent geared income housing, for the most part, is social housing. It's now called community housing. That's what Renee was speaking about. And in those cases, it's approximately 30% of a family's income is spent on rent, the rent component. And so, as you can imagine, that housing is both in demand and certainly needed in our community. If I think about Hamilton right now, we have over 6,000 people on the wait list for that rent geared to income housing in Hamilton. And those are all individuals and families who qualify. So they certainly are in a place where their income only supports that level of housing. However, we just don't have the housing stock available. The housing stock that is in that rent geared to income category, I guess, if you will, for the most part is city housing. So City Housing Hamilton has housing in that area, as do our not-for-profits, St. Matt's, for example, and there are some co-ops. But for the most part, it's not the private developer, market developers that are playing in that field, that it truly is the smaller not-for-profits. There's lots of benefits to that, of course, but it's limiting on how much we can actually build. So if you think, consider, you know, we might build a couple hundred units a year, but when we're looking at 6,000 individuals who are in need of this housing, for individuals who are on the wait list, it can feel impossible. That's not, those solutions are solutions for some people, but they don't see it for themselves because it takes so long to happen. I think the other piece is that, again, back to our previous conversation, a lot of that housing is coming as housing and not necessarily with specialized supports attached to it. And so, again, that gap continues. I think if we can find ways to better incentivize housing within the private market, we may have some more movement there. I think when we think about the community, it's, you know, profits alone, of course, are not the only profit for a community. The social benefits to a community of housing the individuals who live here, of providing stable locations where people can live so their children can maintain continuity within a school system. It's very disruptive for a family and for a child when they're bouncing from school to school either every year or even more frequently than that. The other problem we have on the RGI side of things, I guess, is there is opportunity for rent supplement programs. So that's where we do tap into private providers, private landlords, and the tenant is paying a portion of the rent, the city is paying the other piece of their rent to provide an affordable unit. But again, the amount of rental units in the city are unfortunately below what we need. And probably about some of the things Ashley talked about, some of the quality of that housing is not necessarily meeting the needs of individuals either. So I think lots of gaps when we think about how the private piece fits in.
Thank you for that. I want to do a queen for a day sort of thing at Queen's Park. If I was queen for a day, I would ensure X, Y, Z happened. Because I think there is a legislative portion of this that can be addressed through changes, protections, as we're talking about with Ashley. How do you feel about vacancy controls, and is that too late? Or, and do you want to explain to people when I'm talking about vacancy control as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, if I were queen for a day, I think I would dream even bigger than vacancy control. I think we need a really big, robust social housing, public housing. We should be thinking beyond people who are in deep poverty when we think about social housing. We should think about it the way we think about our medical system, where so many people are buying in, right? And you've got people with higher incomes who are offsetting the people with lower incomes. And so I would love to see, you know, real buy-in to get us out of the commodification of housing, get us out of the private landlord system. That these are my dreams. But in the smaller, we're just at Queen's Park, we're talking about what kind of legislation changes we can do within the RTA. Vacancy control is the obvious one, right? So vacancy control is where when a tenant moves out, the rent remains the same for the next tenant who moves in. And we had that system in place, I think it was for about 15 years. It ended in Ontario in, I think it was 1996 or 1997. So it meant I'm moving out of my unit, I was paying $1,200. The next tenant moving in is also paying $1,200. And reintroducing something like that would immediately disincentivize landlords from doing these evictions, these no-fault evictions, right? Because the incentive for those evictions is I can get somebody out who's paying me $450 a month and has been there for 30 years, I get them out and now I can charge $2,000. There's obviously a huge immediate financial impact for that landlord. Even if that landlord gets caught, even if they get in trouble, they go to the LTB, the penalties that they pay, they're going to pay that back in no time with the increase in the rent that they're paying. So there's no disincentive. It's actually incentivized even to go and to lie, because you know the greatest penalty you're going to pay if you lie is going to be paid for pretty quickly by that higher rent. So vacancy control would make a huge difference in keeping people housed. And when I talk about those numbers, you know, $450 a month, those are real numbers, right? I see people every day who are paying, they've been in a unit for truly 30 years. And the landlord says, yeah, I could make $2,000 a month. That person has been paying that rent on time. They're diligent. But now they're facing going out into the current rental market where they're looking at $1,800 a month for a one bedroom. Maybe they're on ODSP or OW, and it's just not realistic. And homelessness is the real next step that a lot of those people are facing. So, yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Laura. I think that's a really easy piece of low-hanging fruit is vacancy control. The political will is what we always need, and I don't know if that's there with our current provincial conservative government.
Yeah, that's just it. What are the lobbies saying about, you know, keeping those prices where they're at? And for my part, I've lived in co-ops, I've been on co-op boards, I've been on condo boards. Yes, there's a minimum amount you need to run a unit in these buildings, especially if they still have mortgages from new builds from developers, but it's not the price jumps that we're seeing in the market after people are rent evicted for sure. Before I start with the feds, because thank you for bringing up the role of the federal government in this and their announcement that, you know, we're going to build all these homes. Katrina, do you have any comments on what's said? Please jump in.
So just a few comments. So one of them is sometimes it's not just about affordability. It's about actually qualifying to get a place. So unless you have A1 spotless credit, plus you have a co-signer, plus, you know, all of these things, even if you had the money to put down, chances are you aren't going to get in. You can't rent an apartment. And I've seen it even with my own children, you know, and even if their dad wants to co-sign for them or anything like that, they still won't get into a building. And it's ridiculous because some of them have some very big incomes, but that doesn't matter. Or somebody who's on ODSP, you know, they sign over their rent every month, the landlord's guarantee, they've never, ever had a problem anywhere they've lived, but they won't even be looked at just because they're on social assistance. So I think, you know, we have to take a look at that. I also, again, the inclusionary zoning was a big thing for me that I really loved, is that we could, if we're going to give out building permits in this city, or let's start with the city, then every building permit for commercial housings needs to be a certain percentage set aside for affordable housing. And that brings me back to affordable housing. What does affordable housing mean? So that definition is so broad that if a market rent place is $1 less than that market rent, it becomes affordable. So, you know, how do we make that, you know, how do we make that actually affordable? So, you know, those are just some of the things that I think about if I were queen for the day.
I see my idea of queen for the day just sort of took off. Yes, there. Exactly. Affordability has always been a bone of contention for me. What's affordable? What's average? I'm not good with average income. Sorry, I'll put my mic a little closer to my mouth. What is, honestly, why are we going with average incomes when we know median incomes don't qualify for mortgages or anything in this city to actually purchase? We know the average rent is more than people can afford, more than the 30% RGI level. I think it was 64,000, and that came out from CMHC a year ago, 2 years ago. And we have the SPRC right now saying singles are far lower in income than that. So we have a problem of affordability, and for who, and how do we get that? And I'm totally with you on the inclusionary zoning and what it's going to take to make that a regular thing that we do in the city, without the NIMBYism. And that's the other, I think, flip side with inclusionary zoning. But I'm going to move to the feds, because we elected a government, whether personally or not, that says we're going to build all these homes. You know, we did it post-war, we can do it again, it's possible. Like the province, are they missing the boat about this, you know, cycle of housing and where it's broken down? Like, is it just a matter of building, or are we talking about building affordable? We haven't seen anything specifically come out, but what would your calls to the feds be? Is it enough? You know, Renee's type housing, is that enough to be repeatable, to do the number of homes they're talking about? Just throw it out there. Like, what are you thinking? I'm sorry, I'm talking way too much for this webinar. So well, give it to you.
So, and Tom, and you know, all of us around the screen will say, we've been screaming about this for 20, 25 years. I mean, ever since the feds, the province got out of the social housing market, you know, in the 1990s, you know, it shows you how long this has been a crisis in the making. And for many of us, we're just like, told you so. And I hate being that person, right? I think the other piece of it that we need to remind ourselves are the global implications of what's happening, right? It's not just happening here in Hamilton, Ontario, or just in Canada. This is happening around the world. This is increasing disparity of income that globalization has given us. What, you know, the hope or what I would say, you know, with, alongside what the feds are doing, is certainly giving us the tools. And when I say the tools, the cash, obviously, and then helping municipalities do things like, free up more land for development and free up land that is deemed inclusionary right from the start. Really knuckling down on the math as to what would the sweet spot be to be able to have enough housing that could fund the affordability, right? If you say a third that was on the market and two thirds of a building was, 30% of income or 20%. Is that the sweet spot? Who's done the math on that recently? But CMHC itself, right, the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, is such a barrier for many of us who have developed or received funding or worked with and through. And so with this new Liberal government, do we have an opportunity to really look, to have them look internally, have a good look in your own soul, and making sure that they have done everything in their power to break down any systemic barriers, alongside finding the funding for things like more modular builds, or, you know, if you're not a fan of that, try a different type of build, but certainly something that could be built quicker than these big, big buildings that take forever and can address the missing middle in a city like Hamilton and has the protections in place long-term, working with the province around the affordability piece and ensure that this federal government comes back to the table to talk about basic income.
And for those of you that don't know, you can Google. There are older YouTube videos of our current prime minister talking about basic income. So just putting that out there because I am from the round table and I do talk about poverty and income. So, Michelle, do you want to talk about working with the feds and the municipality?
Yeah, so from a municipal perspective, working with the feds, I mean, I guess there's a couple different ways that that happens. So we do have some capital investment dollars that flow through the feds, and that continues. We've seen a bit more of that in previous years through the rapid housing initiatives. The National Housing Strategy is a federal housing strategy, and it had goals like ending homelessness in Canada or reducing homelessness in Canada. I think that we see that housing strategy is still in place, Laura, and still continues. And we still have funding locally through something called Reaching Home, which is part of that national housing strategy. However, it's a fairly small budget for us locally. And an important piece is that the federal housing dollars are also intended to address Indigenous homelessness in our community. And quite frankly, it's woefully underfunded from that perspective. We see in Hamilton that Indigenous people are far more likely to find themselves experiencing homelessness than any other population in our community. They're overrepresented among our homeless population. But yet that Reaching Home budget that we receive federally tends to be our smaller housing budget. So certainly there is room for improvement there. We hear that, in a recent election, housing was certainly a platform and the need to address housing issues. So we'll see what comes and whether the National Housing Strategy does get updated to include addressing some of these gaps that we're all talking about here today. Because in the city right now, the largest proportion of housing investment dollars is coming from the municipal taxpayer rather than the provincial or federal government, which both obviously have larger budgets, but housing really is within the provincial mandate to address. So we would see locally that the city is picking up the gaps. We are very fortunate in Hamilton that we live and work in a very caring and compassionate community, and the municipality is trying to address some of those shortcomings, but we're not seeing right now that the National Housing Strategy is addressing the needs for people that are here.
Thank you for that. And I just want to pause and say thank you to the city. I know they bear the brunt of criticism around homelessness in the city. And I mean, really everything, they bear the brunt of criticism around, justly or not. But you have been doing a lot that people don't realize actually happens behind the scenes, and the pots of money that are available, and that you can't just stick it all in one spot. You have to obey regulations around different funding streams. And so it's complex for sure. Keeping people housed and trying to look at the federal one. I mean, we already talked about basic income, which I think is a huge issue around keeping people housed. Anyone want to dig in a little more around, I'm looking at the time, just around awareness? And if we could talk to the community directly and say, this is what's happening, this is what we need your support on. And I don't mean necessarily dollars. I guess I'm looking at stigma and talking about NIMBYism and talking, you know, just this misunderstanding, I think, at times between what's happening and what the cause is versus what's actually happening and what we need to do to change it. Like, I know I live in Corktown community, and there's a lot of anger over the years around homelessness. People don't understand it. I just shared something recently about addictions, and, you know, addictions are medical conditions. They're not, you know, poor judgment calls on the part of individuals. So the work you do, if you could reach out to people, what would you tell them about the need and why it's required and maybe where there's misunderstanding? Sorry for that long question.
Can I start on that one more? And then I think others probably have a lot more to offer. It's a great question. And what can people do? Because I think that we always point to them, well, we need more money, or we need more houses, or we need. The NIMBYism is real. Like, we've seen it in our community, and it's funny because we see it from all different ways. That you're right, lots of people are angry about the issues around homelessness. I can tell you there's not a person in the community who's experiencing homelessness that chose to find themselves homeless, that chose to sleep in a park, or chose to have to pick up their family and take them to a shelter tonight. That those are things people are doing out of necessity because they're an urgent crisis situation. And I think that we see on the flip side of that, not only are people angry about homelessness, people are angry when we try to build affordable housing in particular areas or build social housing, community housing units. And in fact, we have community housing all over the city, lots of rental units people probably don't even know are affordable housing, and they operate perfectly well as part of the community. It's just another piece to the community. And I think that when people push back on all of this, really, it's just exacerbating the homelessness issue, and it's further amplifying that stigma, which is making it even more difficult for people to reach out. Because when that stigma is there and all we hear is about how terrible, Renee, you said it before, we blame people that they're the problem as opposed to the systems, and the lack of systems, quite frankly, is really what the problem is. So we blame the individuals. So then it's really hard for the individuals to seek help because there's so much shame in admitting that somehow we need help. And quite frankly, every one of us needs help at one point, whether it's help with housing, that's one part. It might be help with taking care of children, taking care of elders, taking care of ourselves, our own mental health. And I think there shouldn't be shame in that. And unfortunately, the way we, and I say collective, we, not necessarily us, but the community, treats people that are finding themselves really very vulnerable and unfortunate situations further compounds that problem as opposed to supporting it. So if we could be just maybe a little kinder and thinking about all these individuals that are finding themselves in those situations, it could be any one of us. Could be any one of us, could be our brother, could be our sister, child, or other, and our friend. And there's nothing particularly different about these folks. It's like the rest of us. We have to be kinder as a community.
Michelle and her department has been a big part of how St. Matt's is helping to build that kindness and sense of compassion and community. I'm not sure if folks know that we operate a drop-in center at Myler Hall. Many of you are familiar with Myler Hall at the corner of James and Barton. And we see up to 200 people a day at the drop-in center. And folks get to come in, have a hot meal, talk to others, be in community, and have around them all the available supports if and when they wish or need or are ready to speak to someone. In addition to that, and these are, you know, social workers and all kinds of intensive case managers and supports that we've managed to assemble there. But the other piece of it is, and sorry, Craig, I hit my table because I waved my hands around too much. The other piece of it is there are over 200 volunteers that work with us at this cafe, at the Cathedral Cafe, as we call it. And I can tell you that this is changing hearts and minds of people who come and support and volunteer and just be in community with the folks who come to the cafe. And they go home and they talk about it with their friends and their neighbors. And they're really trying to bring that work that they do to others in community to try and build that dialogue. You know, if I had an opportunity to speak to the community, I'd say to them, why don't you come by and spend some time at the cafe to understand both systemically what people face as barriers, but also, you know, what kind of supports are available. You know, we've heard very much so that there are lots of supports available in the city, but it's making that human connection and giving the people the ability to cross the bridge to make that connection to happen. So more services and programs like this, I think, would be helpful. You know, there's a lot of faith groups that do try to do charitable work, but sometimes they miss the mark because the relationships aren't sustained. It's sort of like what I was saying earlier about food banks. It's not just about handing over a bag of food. You know, it's about the life support that comes with all of that work together. So again, we've been blessed. I don't mean that, you know, in any kind of silly way, but in a serious way, we've been blessed because of our partnership with the city and our partnership with this faith group that is willing to change how it does its work so that they can address some of the root causes in a better way.
Thank you. I think you touched on something that is key, and it's the connection with the person you're serving. It should be people-centered when you're doing your work, and I know everyone here does that, because you can very easily miss the mark when it's not person-centered work, and not understanding the needs of the community you're serving, et cetera, et cetera. I know that's not exactly what you said, but it made me think of it, and it happens so often. We had a request. We have 10 minutes left, so I'm going to throw it out there. So if you're going to say something, I'm sorry, you could probably still say it, but we're going to move on. I want to talk about residential care facilities. And it sort of leads to next month's topic as well, Canada Disability Benefit, but I won't go there today. Both public and for-profit. And talking about, do we expand that? Do we change it up? Because this is a key part, probably for some of the most vulnerable people in our community, of where they live, how they can, sustainably exist without losing it. You know, we've tried group homes in the 90s when this hospital on the mountain closed and they didn't have enough support. So where are we at today? If you want to comment, do we want to change it up? Should we be looking at something else? I'm not the expert. All of you are. So
if I can, I'm sorry I'm jumping in on this again, but I'll try and be brief. I was able to spend some time with the Social Planning and Research Council and did some work around residential care facilities and radial separation and NIMBYism and all that kind of stuff around community response. But the missing piece is that from our perspective, my perspective and others, is that certainly there are a lot of private providers that are working to fill this particular gap in the system. However, they don't have to open their books. They don't have to share their finances. The accountability that is required for the RCF system is abysmal. And we see it in the outcome. We see it in the housing. We see it in, how people are treated. And, if there's a way to compel the private sector to open their books and share completely the work that they're doing, I think the dialogue would change pretty quickly. And I wish that there was a way to crack that code. And I know the city has been trying to address it themselves. But it's a tough one, Laura. To me, that would be a game changer.
Can I just step Laura? In on this one?
Both of you. Actually, Katrina, why don't you step in? You've been quiet for a little bit.
So this is kind of personal for me because I have worked in quite a few group homes in a couple different cities. Renee, you hit the nail right on the head. It is deplorable, the conditions that these people live in. It's deplorable how they manipulate, how the providers themselves, who are mostly for profit, get around all of the, requirements. I have brought food from home. I mean, I could go on and on and on, except that unless there is proper oversight and accreditation and all of these things, really they're just capitalizing on poverty some more. It's the poverty pimps, and I know we hate that term, but that's what it boils down to.
Thank you for that. I'll give you poverty pimp because I understand. I get it. Michelle, do you want to address this?
Super quickly, because I think Katrina probably said it better than I could. But so just so everyone knows, though, we do have a review underway right now with an external provider to look at the funding framework for the subsidized RCF. So the RCFs in Hamilton, for the most part, are private. Like, I could count on one hand the number that are not for profit providers. The rest of them are all private market, and they are simply funded on a per diem funding basis. So, and at the end of the day, they're privately owned. So, of course, there is revenue generation that's happening. And so, we do have a review underway looking at the whole funding formula, looking at RCFs, how they operate, and the levels of supports, because they are funded through our provincial homelessness prevention budget. That's how the RCFs operate. And in a previous evaluation, it was clarified really that they aren't necessarily doing what they're supposed to do with respect to their mandates. And so now we're looking at how we fund them, what the outcomes could look like, and how are those two better tied together. So hoping to see some better outcomes on that front, because they are a critical piece of the system that we have to get right.
Fantastic. Ashley, do you have anything on this or something you think we haven't touched on, because we're coming up to the hour?
I don't really do a lot of work in RCS myself, so I don't think anything to add that the folks here haven't covered on that topic. Maybe I can just briefly, as we're wrapping up, go back to your previous question, Laura, about what would I say to the community. And I think through this conversation, and what comes to mind a lot for me is the need to kind of work together and to realize that the people in any of these situations in precarious housing who are facing homelessness, they could very easily be you. And so I think we need a lot more empathy and compassion and understanding for how the systems are all working together to really disadvantage people. And that's not just people who are deeply impoverished. It's so many of us, and in so many different ways. And I think, you know, working together, talking together, realizing how everyone struggles, whether it's about housing, whether it's about work, whether it's about disability, no matter what it's about, there's so many interrelationships there. And I think community building is going to, at the end of the day, be more important than relying on our governments, no matter what level of government. There's so many internal contradictions about the work that we're talking about today, right? We have the federal government and we're happy that they're building housing, but they're not really interested in taxing corporations. They're not interested in changing how our system actually works and like regaining that wealth from people. The province wants to build housing, but it's not going to introduce vacancy control. The city is, you know, obviously doing so much on city housing, but we're forcibly removing encampment residents and we're funding the police to do that. So there's so many internal contradictions in these systems of power that I think we need to be really critical of and needs to kind of think about each other. Where are we within these systems? What can we do together to kind of regain some power from these systems, but also realize that we need to lean on each other if we're going to move anywhere?
I love you guys. I've just decided you're going to be my go-to housing group from now on as I write reports, because you've been so helpful in this conversation. And I agree, Ashley. Back in the 90s, I became unemployed, left one employer. My relationship ended. I was living with someone. And lo and behold, I became homeless. There were only so many couches in my network of people. And all of a sudden, I was sleeping in my car. And so it's not something I ever in a million years would have thought. I didn't have disability back then. I simply became unemployed at the wrong time at the ending of a relationship. And I didn't qualify for shelter because I wasn't abused, etc. So there are so many things. Yes, it can happen to you. And I think that's where my personal empathy started. But hopefully it doesn't take everyone becoming homeless at some point for us to come together as a community. So thank you all for being my community, for sharing your knowledge with all of us. And next month, we will be talking about the Canada Disability Benefit and what the feds and the province still have to do to make this something that doesn't impact RGI. Here we go, still talking housing, that doesn't adversely impact tax credits as well. So please come out June 17th. That's when we'll be doing our next webinar. Please sign up as soon as possible. And thank you so much to each of you on the panel today. Craig in the background, Tom in the background, both of them feeding us important information and keeping us on track. And of course, to the participants and whoever's listening to a podcast in the future, thanks for coming out. Have a great day, everyone.